to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined tonight by Adam Camilleri.
I am inevitable on all your podcasts.
Red Powell.
Good evening.
And Archon Scari.
Deep from the webway I come.
Welcome, guys. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for listening. I'll start off this bit with some housekeeping. Over the next week or two, going to be changing the feed source. It should be absolutely invisible on you guys' side, but you know, keep a lookout. Keep a look. If a couple of weeks go by and you don't hear from the show, we're definitely going to be publishing every week. So be on the lookout for that. Of course, if you listen through YouTube or something like that, it's its own thing. You don't have to worry about it. But any other place gets it from a singular source, and I'm going to be messing around with that a little bit. So please keep on the lookout. Just want to lead off with that housekeeping, just in case. We are the Bella Lost Souls Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Guys, we promised we're going to talk about Xenos, and I thought, who better to bring on than someone, I mean, you're not a complete single faction player, Scari, but you definitely know how to hang on during the lean times of your whatever your particular faction is, and you know, I thought you'd be a great person to speak with on this.
You know, as cryptic as I can be in these cryptic times, I will try and impart the wisdom of the Eldari.
Well, this is still early days of 9th edition, and on this show, I also I'm going to bring back some finishing moves, although it's going to be like opening moves. I'm still going to call it finishing moves is the hobby segment, and I want to talk about putting together your push fit models and getting some additional mileage out of them, and also how to maybe get them to look a little bit better, you know, no matter how you're assembling them. And this actually, we got reminded by a listener, who's been a long-time listener of the show and remembers when we were talking about push fits for a previous edition or Sigmar, and it still applies now. So you can really get some good effects out of these miniatures, and we're going to talk a little bit about that later on in the show.
Nice. I'm excited. Those push fit models are cool.
Like, share, and subscribe. Thanks. That's fine. I'm trying to get better at talking about this stuff. Thanks for bearing with me. I'll edit it up. It'll be fine. Let me just start over. This is the People's Murphy. Thank you for tuning in.
Round two. Fight.
No, we're going with it. We're going with it. Okay, so Xenos. Now, I know we talked a bit about Tyranids, and I'm happy to report that we did not get near the flack that we normally do for talking about Tyranids.
Do you know why that is?
Digest.
It's simply because it's the start of 9th edition and no one knows better yet. That's it. We can say whatever we want.
Well, just to kind of link it, you know, to fall back on what we were talking about is that you do get to take a lot of what, at least I think we believe is going to be good things in this edition right now. You know, a bunch of kind of inexpensive units that you can get extra utility out of. You don't care if a unit of gaunts is somewhere gnawing on an objective or something. You could use them to ring things. And I think they've got some kind of things built into the points. I do want to lead out, before we talk about the Eldari stuff, is the Super Tuna is back, folks. It is aggressively pointed, and you're going to, if you play against a longtime Tau player who has one of those things, you expect to see it on the table. You need to pack what you need to pack to take to deal with it.
Yeah, just accept. Agreed. You're going to run into it.
Yeah, it's going to be there. It's going to be big. It's going to be scary. It's going to shoot a lot of stuff. So have fun.
Well, the only upside is they can't take it with like 40 shield drones anymore, because that's like the entire rest of the army. So it's balanced out by them hopefully having to take gun drones and some measure of shield drones or marker drones, and at least diversifying that. And that is a decent balancing thing, because the worst thing that could happen was that you don't do any damage to it for like three turns because of shield drones, and then you don't have enough turns left to have any options anymore. So, but now, you know, possibly you shoot through the drones in first turn or two, and then you can start, you know, making an impact.
Reserve it?
Yes.
So I think you're still going to run into some things to where it's just right there, in that you could hide the rest of your army if you needed to. You could even, you know, go some very survivable, defensible routes, and then you just have that thing. It's like a Castellan on steroids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least it's not like a Riptide where you have three different targets. So if you can only shoot it, you know, it's not like you really have a choice. So you might as well just shoot it.
Wise
exactly
words.
Right. Well, yeah. They're not going to have anything else in their army, are they? So literally, there it is.
Yeah. Although, transports and stuff, I think the transport thing is real. And we talked a little bit about that. Red, I don't know if you had any opportunity to play around with that list idea that you were working about, but it ties into, you know, we have the Darkkin expert on the line right now.
Yeah. Scary. I was looking at, the 8th edition rendition of Venom Spam and Raiders. I've always been a big fan of Raiders. And I was wondering, maybe from your perspective, what do you think about Dark Eldar and transport spam?
So it really depends on what obsessions you're going to be running. I think there's something to be said about running a dark technomancer army that's, you know, reliant on venoms and raiders as like a really, especially since ravagers and other sort of like fire support options have gone up in points quite a lot. It gives you something to work with that'll do a lot of damage and sort of play to the strengths of the army. A lot, personally. In my list, you know, in the style of list that I've gone for, which is a little different, I don't rely as much on the transports themselves. I don't really take that many. I only have two Venoms in my list. But, they are probably one of the more efficient sort of like damage outputs in the army if you build around them. You can't just take a bunch of them and expect it to be good. You have to do it with purpose.
Mm-hmm. When you say dark technomancer thing, like what do you... What's your plan there?
So Dark Technomancer is a coven obsession, right? So it's part of the Psychic Awakening, custom obsessions for the Dark Eldar, for the coven, which are the, homunculus units. And it's one of two traits that you can pick for your coven army that gives you the ability to pick a weapon when you shoot. And when it shoots, it'll get +1 to wound and +1 damage. Right, so this could be a splinter cannon on a venom, getting +1 to wound and +1 damage. And it can be a disintegrated cannon or a dark lance on a raider that would get +1 to wound and +1 damage, which can be pretty handy. Now, like a plasma gun that's overcharging, it can take damage on a 1, but it's not on a 1 to hit, it's on a 1 to wound, which is an interesting little dynamic. It's not an auto death, you just take a single mortal wound. So combined with things like venoms, which normally don't do a lot of damage, right, which have poison, which now wound vehicles on, say, 5s instead of 6s, and, infantry or other things on 3s instead of 4s, and then become 2 damage, all of a sudden you have, like, these little transports that pack a really big punch, considering, they're, like, for their cost. And on things like raiders with disintegrators or lances, having a disintegrated cannon that has 3 damage a shot might finally be worth its point value now, and or a dark lance that becomes essentially able to wound knights on 3s, which is pretty cool. And
I would imagine, right?
Yeah, and anything that's like big, and it just makes it very easy for you to wound things and do damage, and subbing it out with like a multiple small unit full of transports means that you can offset the lack of durability from, say, an extra invulnerable save, not on vehicles, but on like Grotesque or Talos, or the Feel No Pain that you're going to be using on like the Cabala Blackheart units as well. You make up for that by just sheer firepower and damage output.
What's the core of this? So like, what are you choosing to go inside them? What are you putting around it?
So a lot of the times it's you try and put as many things in the army that let you take as many vehicles as possible, but it'll be mostly racks. You're taking racks and other infantry units that allow you to like mandrakes, racks, other things like that, that let you take more vehicles and just kind of double down on those. You can also supplement it well with a couple of like Forge World Drukhari units, like Forge World Reapers, which are it's like a Ravager looking tank with a giant gun at the front. I don't know if you've seen one of those.
It looks like a wand or something, almost like a...
Yeah, right? It's like that alone is a D6 like lance shot gun, basically. So it's like a Ravager, but with Dark Technomancers, it becomes +1 wound, +1 damage. And it becomes one of the
a very, very scary option for like a support unit. So at its core, you have decent infantry and racks. You've got a good amount of characters that can support. You've got vehicles in this style of list that do more damage than they should be doing because leveraging the obsession. And then you can sort of like sprinkle in units like Talos or Kronos, which I feel really shine with their weapons doing plus one to wound, plus one damage. You know, especially with things like Haywire. Haywire on Talos getting plus one to wound is really cool. It means they trigger D3 mortals on a 5 or 6 instead of a 6. You know, then all of a sudden they also become 2 damage each. Like if they do wound a vehicle or like even infantry. And even they can start doing a lot of hefty like damage as well.
Multi-wound infantry we know we're going to see because that's what the Marines have. I mean, you're going to see it all over the place. And vehicles. I mean, if we're saying supporting that the transport meta is going to be real or whatever, then it sounds like this is a pretty, at least out the gate, optimal build.
Yeah, it's definitely a good build. You know, it does compete with the Prophets of Flesh like durability style list. However, time will tell, you know, which one just becomes more efficient over time.
Well, I think people played Prophets of Flesh because that was the most optimized thing. I mean, because they had to, essentially. If they were going to go and compete, then they had to have that type of durability. But, you know, now the doors are wide open.
New edition, new time to explore.
Yeah, well, if you can explore something and you get the benefit of being able to interact with the board, like my experience with Prophets of Flesh list is that unless you pair it with Harlequins, then you're essentially just playing that midfield board control. But I say midfield board control is that you were getting up to the middle of the table, someone was engaging you, and you sit there for 4 turns. This sounds, the thing you're discussing now sounds like you can be a little bit more interactive all over the table.
Yeah, it also means that like your small, like more fragile units become more effective at dealing damage and, you know, sort of like being able to keep up that rate of attrition throughout like a shorter game where you don't have to worry too much about having to survive the 6 turns. You can survive the 5 turns and really kind of put a lot of pressure downfield for a very limited amount of time.
That's interesting. I haven't really thought about this, but the Toughness 3 armies just as a whole, seem to benefit from less opportunity to be shot by bolters.
Yes.
can we talk about that for a second? Anybody got any like thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure Adam can probably go much further than I can in that regard. But I mean, you know, whether it's Eldar troops or whatnot, not to step too far away from the Xenos, but I mean, Toughness 3 models, you know, I saw some people playing Tau, and this was still 8th edition, but, you know, looking into 9th edition now, you know, Tau battalions or brigades and having fire warriors all over the place. I'm sitting here painting, I'm on my 40th guardsman right now of my Gaunt's Ghosts. And I mean, you flood the board with literally 100 T3 models and then tell people to target prioritize, you know, I mean, custodes are tough and all, but they got to chew through all my T3 models that are sitting on objectives and count just as much as they do.
Yeah, they're also all functionally the same. Like if you did have that type of, I mean, I know we've talked about whether hordes are alive or dead, like who knows right now. But in the situation you're describing, whether it be guardians, guardsmen, dark Eldar warriors or whatever.
Termagants.
Yeah, they're all like, there are 100 of them and they're all functionally the same. Like killing 10 of them doesn't really reduce any operational capacity.
Hmm.
I guess tactical flexibility, you know, maybe of whatever list you're shooting at.
Yep. And with only 5 turns, I mean, there is the capability. And so looking at Necrons, right? I mean, I admit I am excited for Necrons and I'm looking forward to the Codex come October alongside the rightful Sons of the Empire, the Space Marine Codex that comes out at the same time. There's some weight now. Necron warriors are still pretty expensive in comparison. You know, a guardsman is 5 points. I think fire warriors are somewhere between 7 and 9. A Necron warrior is still 12 points.
Yeah.
But they've got the ability to hang in there with reanimation protocols, and we really got to see what that looks like. But I've played
four, aren't they? Are they toughness 4?
They are, and yeah. So to be fair, yeah, they are.
But a 4-up armor save, so it's basically tinfoil. They're basically effectively toughest 3.
might as well be tinfoil in regards to how much AP is out there, right?
But I don't feel that way now, though. I mean, I think that maybe we might see a shift to more people trying to take bolters and the heavy bolters and stuff like that for volume of fire. And so, I mean, you are getting that neg one, but you can cancel it out with some terrain. We should talk about terrain at some point too, because appropriately labeling the terrain at the beginning of the game will also help your army.
Will massively impact the way that the game is played.
Sorry, I jumped in there.
No. The terrain things, absolutely. I mean, as Scar is saying, it's critical being able to understand what terrain is on the table and what you're going with. And you need to be, I mean, there should be no question of exactly what terrain is. And I've seen some of the events, even just the handful that are getting out there right now. I mean, they're upfront labeling terrain out the gate without any issue, you know.
For organized play, I think you should. I mean, as an organizer, you get to help. It's a throttle. It's a control for the fun. Like, you just want people to have a good time. And one of the ways to absolutely just dump cold water on someone is have the terrain not be functional. And thankfully, because of this keyword system, we can make some otherwise sketchy terrain functional. And I know, again, I don't want to get us too, maybe we talk about that after the break, before the hobby segment, but that's, it's critical. And a shorter turn or a shorter game with more fragile models in cool terrain opens up what builds you could functionally do. So I mean, I don't know. I'm not trying to answer, whether hordes are alive or dead again or whatever. But an Eldar Guardian isn't looking so terrible anymore.
No. Well, I mean, Scar, you can probably talk more to this Eldar transports period, right? The Falcon, man. What are they called?
Wave serpents.
Wave serpents, man. That'll
also Falcons, by the way.
Yeah,
Falcons are legit.
Was talking to me about that exact game he played and was comparing the Wave Serpent to the Falcon. Now they do, they share a lot of traits. They're both transports. They both have similar movement characteristics, and they both are basically gunboats. I mean, the Falcon has heavier guns, but it could perform some of the same function, and the Wave Serpent beat it hands down because of that, because of things people trying to take in, shoehorn in D2 weapons, and the Wave Serpent just doesn't care about it, and the Falcon does.
Like, there is something to be said for the absolute and ridiculous longevity that Wave Serpents have had in our game, from the start of 8th edition to the end of 8th edition, through points changes, rules changes, whatever changes you want. Wave Serpents have stayed good, and that's because of their ability to stay on the table. Like, no matter what you say for damage output or how explosive things can be with the right amount of stratagems, you got to say exactly the same things about things that are able to stay on the table and continue to do a job consistently for you. And that's the reason I think Wave Serpents are always going to be good.
Yeah, God. I mean, Wave Serpents, I mean, I shouldn't say not with, but the not being able to stack the negatives to hit.
It does hurt it, but the thing is, it can always have -1 to hit no matter what you take, whether it's LA talk or not LA talk. You can always lightning fast for a -1 to hit, or through clever use of terrain, you can get a -1 to hit maybe. You also have conceal and protect. There are numerous ways to buff it and make it more survivable, and it's already the most survivable transport in the game. I believe that's a correct statement. I was just thinking, is impulses more reliable? No, I don't think so. I think the -1 damage beats out the 4+ on the impulser.
-1 damage is so important.
It's so ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And also, when you couple that with the fact that you can put legitimate guns on it. I mean, star cannons now look really good. Putting two star cannons on a wave serpent isn't a horrible idea anymore. And all of a sudden, it's a really reliable shooting platform against a lot of the multi-wound stuff we were talking about before, while it just sticks around forever, and it's just such a nuisance.
It's got those shurikens on the bottom. I mean, it can hold things that don't have insignificant guns in them.
It's got 13 wounds, and you give it a 6+ feel no pain, so it essentially ends up becoming a 15-wound tank if you put the ifs and buts through the averages. It just becomes a ridiculously good platform.
I love them.
Esoterically as well, or more like on the sidelines, the addition of the command point changes means that it's always got a smite. You know what I mean? Like, if you want it to have it, because you're going to get that CP every turn anyway. So if you need an extra D3 mortal wounds, that shield can come in handy late game, not just absolutely, like when you need it in that first game, which, if you need to kill that knight on one wound or something.
Yeah, exactly right.
So good. I mean, which is great. If you've been a player of the faction for a long time, you have them, so wheel them out. But I know I jumped to the end there, at least what my opinion was, but the Falcons, you think there's some legs on them as well?
Yes, definitely. I think Falcons, their transport, a lot of people are kind of resorting to an MSU-style build of like small units of Dire Avengers, you know, so you can carry 6 models in a Falcon. And it has access to some really good guns. It's got a Pulsar laser, which is really good. And then it's a Pulsar, whatever. And it's got access to like a rocket launcher or like an Eldar missile launcher or a star cannon or other heavy firepower. And then best of all, it's really cheap in comparison to other gunboats, like, say, a Ravager.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's what, 120 points or something for a Falcon, 130 points, where, you know, it's a transport and has, you know, all these cool Eldar stuff. And a Ravager with disintegrators is like 160 points and has no transport capacity and less wounds and, you know, not as good of a save. So, you know, I feel like there's still a lot to be said about that sort of mechanized Eldari, quick, fast strike style sword wind army, right, that you hear about in the stories, but that kind of plays well on the tabletop while keeping some of that punch, but also having like built-in durability. Because of the fact, A, it's now 5 turns, not 6 turns, so you're not going to take as many shooting phases. And B, you know, you're crazy fast. And in this game, especially with all the Xenos armies, I think Xenos armies should really focus on that board control element and being able to be like everywhere on the table once to take objectives and deny points and just kind of be annoying, mostly.
Being able to deposit those troops out of these things that do seem like they are pretty, I mean, I don't know if they're aggressive as this aggressively pointed. I feel like I use that too much, but they definitely seem to have an advantage over some of the point increases that other, what might've been similar things got.
I think speed and like the ability to move fast and move over things has been sort of like a premium points cost in 9th edition. And after playing many games, I can see why it's premiumly costed, because you can, you know, this is all about, you know, taking that primary points and holding objectives and defending objectives. And if there's something that Xenos armies like Eldar do well, it's stopping you from holding your objective, right? And like denying it or contesting it or whatever. And having that speed to do it is just really, really strong within the game mechanics. So those points increases that, you know, we're seeing, I feel, at least at the start, are warranted.
Now, when you say Xenos and you say that kind of quick, agile kind of play style, do you think that translates over to things that have been conventionally thought as a slower armies, e.g. Orcs, Necrons, Tau?
I do think so. I think, you know, A, you've got access to being able to outflank, right, with the skills, which gives access to the ability of every army to sort of increase the sort of like board presence around the table, number one. And secondly, you know, it sort of increases the value of maybe some elements of lists that you hadn't really seen before. Like orcs themselves have always had elements in the army that favor speed and mobility. You've got the jump, you've got ability to put things in the teleportarium. So them themselves, the fact is most people didn't really use it as much as they could have. Like you had like one big unit that kind of like jumped up at you and then a bunch of cannon just shot you off the table with a shock attack gun, right? So in terms of the fact that they had the elements there, just the game style or the gameplay format didn't really lend itself to people extracting the value out of those specific, like rules interactions, right? When it comes to things like Tyranids, right? Tyranids have some of the coolest board control elements that any army has. They have the ability to take cover away from the table, first of all. They can literally just like make a piece of terrain not give cover, right? And then they have, you know, things like spore cysts, you know, that deploy up on the board and poop out little spores for free.
Poop out frustration per turn.
Yeah, every single turn. And they could be all over the table. They, you know, they mess up your deep strikes. You know, they just are in the way. You want to kill them. You don't want to kill them because it's not worth shooting them, but they're pooping out little smites, like little floating smites. That's what those little things are. And, you know, this weekend I ran a tournament, and I will say I've seen so many of those little pooped out things kill so many Custodes and Grey Knights. It was hilarious.
Oof.
Because they're just little smites floating around. But it's not just that. It's Trigon tunnels. It's, you know, mycetic spores. It's, there's so many different things that like Xenos armies have access to that let them sort of be all over the place. And I think that in this edition, you would be wise as a Xenos player to read through your codex again. You know, read through your codex and find things that might have been like pushed under the rug and covered up in the shadows, or, you know, and then like breathe new light into them or new life into them based on the mission format that we're playing right now.
Yeah. So,
that was
so,
a very long-winded answer for that.
No, it's right on. Right. So just like you said, so for Necrons, I habitually back in 8th edition took a, you know, and of course without our codex update yet until October, we still have the same dynasties that we've had for years now. And I was always taking the Nephrek dynasty, which its dynastic code allowed you that if you advanced, you auto advanced a full 6 inches, and you did it as if you had fly. So you could move through, you know, essentially terrain and other models. And I was using that back then for quick grabs at the end or something like that. And right now, exactly to your point, Skari, in regards of objectives and being able to get up front and then to take into effect some of the Indomitus stuff. So the nice thing that came with Indomitus was the increase to first the Overlord. Now it's not, he does have, you know, part of my will be done is he still selects one unit, but he also has more of an aura effect, which is a huge increase. The next part being the Royal Guard, which is kind of like a mean beefed up looking immortal, which looks awesome.
I love that guy.
He's
awesome. The Royal Ward. And his ability is essentially pick a unit within 6 inches and it can fall back and then shoot, which is huge because, coming from a guy who was running mobs of warriors, and you take this new, the new gun they've got, the Reaper, the Gauss Reaper, which is strength 5, AP minus 2, 1 damage. Rapid fire. It's only 14 inches, right? So people are, when you start looking at that range, you're like, oh, it's, you know, 14 in comparison to the flare, which is 24 inches rapid fire one. And so, of course, you're only getting those two shots at 7 inches. However, I assure you, if you're putting those guys on the objective and you use Nephrek to get there sooner, and then you put them on the objective and then they get charged or what have you, that those royal, the guards, they're going to allow you to back up and then shoot. I mean, that's it is definitely not the same thing that it was before, and there's a lot more opportunity to that that people can take advantage of as Necron players.
There's also, even right now before the new codex, there's a lot of ways to make Necron warriors, while not excel in combat, pretty respectable. Like there's Anrukir for +1 attack, and there's also a stratagem for +1 strength as well. So you could give these guys, you've got 20 dudes that have 40 strength 5 attacks in combat before you back out. And so charging them, knowing that they can do both of these things, like firstly hit you hard on the return and then back up and shoot you dead, becomes pretty intimidating.
Hey, well, you can bring the new Cesaric from Pariah, and he can plus him up, kind of like Bile does for the Chaos Space Marines. You bring him, he can do that. And then, so I really enjoy, which people didn't really see it coming. And to a point, the new reanimators have that effect of increasing reanimation protocols. But I also, right now as it stands, a ghost arc for any squad that is within 3 inches of a ghost arc essentially gets to reanimate twice, right? So you do your normal reanimation, and then it's not just one squad, but any squad, any unit that is within a ghost arc at 3 inches can reanimate a second time at the end of the movement phase, which is, I mean, that is a massive deal, being able to reanimate twice.
My opponents are guaranteed all of their destroyers to come back. Like, playing against me, that's what happens. You're never going to lose a destroyer if you're playing against me. It's, if you're a Necron player and we square up, it's your lucky day, no matter when and where it is.
Many other days since the day where you walk up to the table and ask, what's your phase out number?
Oh man, sad times. Sad transition.
But on the talk of like durability though, I feel like there are a lot of also like durability options within like Xenos armies. You know, so yes, with Necrons you have a variety of durability. Like Necron Warriors, like reroll once for reanimation now, for example, which is pretty snazzy. Also, let's not even get started on like the fact that a lot of Xenos armies, well, namely Necrons, but I mean, a lot of Xenos armies really like having all those command points to start that they've never really had before. You know, using Necrons as an example, you know, you didn't really have command points before, but Necrons have some really cool and interesting stratagems that you would have never really seen before because you just had like a set number of strats that you wanted to use, and that was pretty much it. But now you're seeing, you know, factions, including Xenos factions, having the CP to be like, ooh, this is a cool stratagem. Ignore the benefits of cover, eh? To your save.
It might have been unattainable before too. I mean, like you just, you know, we've also often talked about the burn rate of your CPs, and you know, that was taking into account a 6-turn game. Now we're a 5-turn game, and you get one back every turn. And you made a good point of using as an opportunity to go and investigate your codex to find those. And Psychic Awakening too. Like every army's been touched in some way, and we all know that there's just some stratagems that you just you mentally wrote them off as soon as you read them because you knew you would never have the CP for them.
Right.
The luxury. There's this term called CP discipline. That's when you've got this little niche CP thing where that you, and this was a lot more prevalent in 8th edition, you were like, okay, I have these 6 CP as a Necron army. They're literally going to be used for these things. One of them being every opponent's shooting phase, I'm going to double up my quantum shielding. And it's going to be a 6-turn game and I've got 6 CP. I'm probably going to use that 3 to 4 times. So I've got 2 CP. To be frivolous with, or reroll a get back up,
playing Eldari, going into some of those games where you know I only started I think with 9 maybe, but 3 of those were burned before the game, and so and I knew that I'm going to need at least 2 turns of lightning fast. So what am I? I'm basically playing this game with 2 CP of discretion, 2 or 3.
Yep, and yep. The CP frivolity, like you can be frivolous with your CP. You can spend it on fun things. They don't have to all be accounted for pre-game now. I think that's really fun. I think that's a really fun element to bring to this edition.
Well, it certainly gives you an opportunity to look at those things. And, you know, the stuff, I mean, most, not every codex, but most codexes have at least 2 pages of things. And you really probably only used 3 of them, you know, a quarter of them are, you know. Stretch it out, see what you got, especially early, you know, early days, you might, or find out how it applies to you. And you know, we're just talking about when you become, like, you look at one dynasty, and that's that probably had a factor into it because either their CP path was, you know, was attainable. Now there may be things that are more attainable because of the changes.
Orcs. Is that something you want to touch on?
Let's take a break. We'll come back and talk about orcs because we'll talk about orcs, terrain, and kitbashing. And maybe one more model tip. It's going to be, come back after the break. See y'all in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, we are back. Gonna be talking about orcs, man. Adam, sorry, I cut you off. I ended the segment.
Ah, so good. We were deep into the end zone with what we're talking about already. But I can't say that I have a prolific knowledge of how I think orcs are going to function going into this edition. But I've had a lot of people raise concerns to me about how the plays they might have, because as Sky was saying before, this is an edition that really favors being dynamic and quick. And on top of that, being quick with things that have OPSEC. Now, the issue with the orc, you can make stuff that orcs have with OPSEC very quick, like by chucking them in trucks and deep striking them and moving them around and advancing and whatnot. But the issue is their longevity once they get to objectives isn't very good. 10 boys doesn't hold an objective very well, and 10 grots holds it even worse. And we know that, not that you'll be punished, but it's going to become a hindrance to you in a lot of ways, having bigger squads. So I was interested what our illustrious panel's ideas were for how you can kind of get orcs working in this new edition, especially in new mission formats.
Meganoms, come on.
Yeah.
30 of them? 30? 30 Meganoms? No more, no less?
If they were scarier before, they're going to be scarier now. Now, look, I also, I don't know.
Issue with Meganobs is they're slow. They're very slow. You have to jump them around to have them in a transport.
But you can, though. So you've now got a couple of different options. You've got, I mean, we'll talk about transports here in a second, but the jump is one thing. You also can just spend CP and have them go into reserves. Mm-hmm. I mean, orcs, you know, you use all your CP, so you don't. They're not one of those ones that benefit from, like, you have all these free now. No, you're still going to use them all. but I think with the combined obscuring terrain, the jump... possibly some transports. I mean, even things like battle wagons. I wouldn't even rule them out completely. But you mentioned that you thought that boys, might not be good at holding objectives. And boys, while they are fragile, if you distract your opponent with all these other things, when are they going to find the time to deal with them?
To deal with the boys, yeah, that's a very good call. I suppose there's this negative perception that because you can't get a troop's choice for orcs that is under 10, well, let alone under 6 for the brackets for blast weapons and coherency, but they're going to have this issue with board presence because the footprint of their units is always going to be smaller, even though they have larger numbers. So I think Meganobs get around that quite well because they are something that can pack a punch and do some legitimate damage as a 5-man unit. So I think that's a good point. Also, I think MSU looters, am I crazy in thinking MSU looters sitting in a battle wagon is not the worst thing in the world? I know it's not incredibly good, but for picking up other small MSU units, they feel like they're pretty well placed, with their offensive profile.
What do they get to shoot, though? Let's, in theater of the mind here, if there is this obscuring terrain, and then if things are coming in later than they would, then maybe not starting on the table, things that would, what do those looters get to shoot? If we're just trying to have an objective discussion about whether or not they may be good or not.
What you'd be using them for is you could put 2 units of 5 looters in a truck, and then that truck zooms around and gets angles for you to be able to shoot things. Because, yeah, you're right. If they're just standing there on the board and moving their 6 inches, they're not going to get to do much. They might shoot for 2 turns of a game with the opponents using their terrain appropriately. But yeah, as soon as you mount those guys up, they become a lot more flexible. I mean, you could do the same thing with flash kits. I know they went up in cost and a lot of people have been bemoaning that. But you can do a lot of... There are some legit orc shooting in this. The problem is you just got to keep them safe because they're all paper mache.
Yeah, flash kits can catch a break. They are...
Yeah. they're some of the so coolest cool. damn models as well. Yes, they're cool. So cool.
Definitely marine killers.
Yes, they have some good rules interactions. I think orcs can do MSU better than most things can. They've got the ability to have, they can do MSU. So I think they've got, you just haven't really seen, I've seen some orc players do MSU style builds, using a billion buggies, because you can have, 5 buggies to a unit, right? If you're doing the speed freak style build. And some of those buggies, especially now that you don't suffer the penalty for moving and shooting and, you can shoot into combat and whatnot, a lot of those buggies and death dreads and things like that have become more viable as options, in my opinion. As a person who sees orcs from afar and not an actual orc player, I can only give you so much, in terms of advice. However, looking at other options that aren't necessarily in your codex, like Forge World, for example, it's the same as any other faction. And some people are vehemently against Forge World, and some people love the options that Forge World gives your army. But I recently played a game against orcs that used the chin orcs, the helicopters. They're essentially a dedicated transport, but it's a helicopter for orcs.
It's cool.
It's cool. And something that 9th edition Forge World points in the chapter proof did was make it barely more expensive than a truck, but with the armament that even Space Marine Dreadnought would be jealous of.
Oh, wow. So those little machine guns or whatever are packs and punch?
Yes. They have, I think they're called rattling guns or something, or some sort of chain gun of some sort, but it's 0 points. It's included with the chin orc. And it's a 24-inch, 2d6 shots, strength 5, AP minus 2, 2 damage weapon, which, comes at barely the cost. And they're all on a unit of dedicated transport aircraft. So granted, the aircraft themselves can't hold objectives. However, they don't have minimum movement. They fly around. They have bombs, like a Void Raven bomber. They can literally drop bombs on units. And they can carry, 10 models. So you could literally have tank busters, or flash kits, or units of shooter boys, and have a fleet of 8 to 10 of these things running around, taking objectives, getting in the way, because believe it or not, big flyer bases still block movement. They didn't take that away. That's still a thing that can happen. And unless your opponent can fly or do stuff like this, they're not going to really be able to charge into your chin orcs. You're going to have to shoot them down. So you can really play to that MSU style with some crazy lucky shooting.
let's give it a break. Like, orc shooting isn't the best shooting, but they make it up for in volume. And if you have one turn where your dice roll better than average, like, the math just goes crazy in your favor.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. The orc shooting being subpar is basically a myth because they hit a third of the time, but they have three times as many shots.
Correct. So if you have that one turn or two turns where you just happen to hit 50% of the time, your volume of shots is just, your opponents going to feel it, and they're going to feel it hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think orcs are good.
That was exactly what I was getting at. I was just hoping that somebody out there knew, like, a bit of a fringe play, something that orc players can get excited about. I do like the buggy play. There was a tournament in Adelaide this weekend just gone, and it was won by an orc player using masked buggies.
See, I've seen a lot of pictures of people that have done that because it was cool. I mean, they look cool. I mean, you're not going to find a Rucka Truck Swig Buggy in there. You know, maintaining my vow to say that as much as possible, but the rest of them, I think what people may have made them as a gimmick, maybe it ain't half bad.
Well, also, I like a lot of things. I like what I said about the Flying Hive Tyrant. I like the way I now believe about Dread Knights and things of their ilk. The Squig Buggies, though, all the Orc Buggies only got buffs. I mean, even if their points went up, they only got buffs by the rule changes in 9th edition. They're shooting into combat, especially, because they all have like these, a lot of them have these D3 mortal wounds on the charge, and you never wanted to charge them, because you'd be like, oh, I don't want to charge. Why would I want to charge this thing unless there's like one scout left on the objective or something? But now you charge them in, you do some damage, you hit them a couple of times with an Orc profile, you know, strength 4, hitting on 3s. Three or four attacks, and then you're like, oh, sorry, mate, you got to fall back or I'm going to just blitz right into you again. I think that they got a lot of benefits out of those. And those buggies, they're cool models. I will just say they are cool models. They might not be great in game, some of them, but the models are sick.
Not only that, but they have crazy good abilities for like movement as well. Like there's the one that like teleports. All of a sudden it shows up everywhere. So we're talking about durability, we're talking about harassment, we're talking about mobility, we're talking about objective scoring. And it seems to me that there's options in there that tick every box. Is it the most efficient? Probably not. You know, I feel like us 40K players have a tendency to sort of cross-reference everything to go, this isn't as efficient as this other thing in this
country. Yeah.
You know, and I feel that's a really like a fallacy, in the sense that you have to look at it in terms of the mission format and the everything that you have in your army, instead of just like wishing that you had that thing in the other person's army. You know, just play with what you have.
That's really well said. I think you could probably go back and listen to the last 3 or 4 episodes that I've been on, and I pretty much said, it's not fair to do cross-faction comparisons, but we're going to do one right now anyway. Yeah, it's so true, isn't it?
It is fun to do sometimes.
I compared a Tempestus Scion to was it a Dire Avenger or was it a
Dire Avenger?
A Cabalite Warrior. Yeah, yeah. And I was just like, you know, these points don't really compare. Blah 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 blah. But it's apples and oranges. You can only compare them so far. They're still both fruit. You know, they're both fruit. They're both edible. But that's where everything stops.
There's so many factors that go into a unit that's more than just point value and weapons it has access to. It's what
and strength and toughness
can support it, and you know what's its role on the battlefield, and you know how experienced is the person using the unit, and there's just so much other stuff.
Yeah, well said, man. I'm gonna shift our gears to talking about terrain. So terrain still slightly abstract, but not as abstract as before, because I think there are definable terms that you can attach to it in the form of traits. So each terrain feature, this is right out of the book, each terrain feature can have one or more terrain traits, each of which bestows additional rules. Once the battlefield has been created, both players must agree which terrain traits apply to which terrain features. I guess if I could counsel anyone to exercise some give and take in this when you're playing casual games. If you're playing in a tournament game, I think that the organizer should have it labeled, because it's a, you know, like we mentioned before, it's a toggle to the overall experience. And when you're playing casual games or a narrative game, then, you know, you can use this as a tool just to create whatever experience you're hoping to get out of that. Where I wanted to jump past that, talking about it in the abstract, is that technically, you can assign whatever keyword you want to whatever. The next page is in the book go over some common terrain features and what the keywords are associated to it. So you've got a category, and then you've got traits. And then there are some suggestions by the designers. But again, you're only limited, I guess, by your imagination and what you're trying to get out of whatever that piece of foam is you have. That you're, it's your hill. For the last 15 years, it's been your hill. It's been your forest. It's been your barricade or whatever. Now you've actually got some rules you can throw on it that don't have to be the same thing every game.
I do like what you said about the TOs defining the terrain pre-event. I think that's could be a very important thing to do, mostly because I just don't like the idea of two different games happening on the same table and then have the table playing completely differently because of interpretations.
Oh, you're right. We've all heard that story. Oh, well, we played that as heavy cover. Well, we played it as light cover, and that lost me the game.
Exactly right. You wouldn't want to have those. You want to have it consistent throughout an entire event, just for the sake of, the sake of feel bads and the sake of erroneous things happening game to game.
Well, you want a controlled environment in that setting.
Trust me, this what I'm about to say, there is a point to this, and you know, so Adam, to your point about TOs, and we were talking about it earlier, and bringing it back around. So, Paul, you said the book has recommended terrain types, right? Like ruins should have this keyword, this keyword, this keyword, right?
Well, yeah, we'll pick one. So ruined walls has terrain category obstacles, terrain traits as defense line, breachable, dense cover, defensible, unstable position.
Okay, cool. So it's got all the set stuff to it. And we've seen some adaptations where people are already looking at, you know, well, they want to adjust the keywords. And I've even, you know, looked at some of the stuff, and I'm a big fan of making terrain, and I like the different variables you can add to it. But one thing I would say, and again, without going too far off on a tangent, someone gave me their philosophy on, you know, they would do job interviews and they'd go to dinner and they would go to dinner with this other person that they were doing a job interview with. And you'd have a meal. And this was like a fine dining place. And you'd sit down with this meal. And what they waited to see with the other person was if they seasoned their meal before or after they tasted the meal. Hmm. And you can maybe start to see where I'm tying this in. But so, you know, how do you know how the meal tastes before or after you season it, right? Like, I mean, you have to try it to even see if it even tastes good or if you trust that the cook appropriately seasoned it before you even get your hands to it and you just throw salt and pepper or whatever else on there. And so when you look at the terrain rules, how I translate what I just said in that random story to what we're talking about here is that the game designers made their recommendations on exactly how they think some of the terrain should go. And I don't know if we necessarily have tasted enough of the meal that they put out for us to know necessarily whether or not we need to adjust or add or change the keywords associated with it to determine if we need more seasoning, using my my metaphor here.
And that's
just something that I'd throw out there. I'd caution for anybody. I think it's totally worthwhile to just try what the designers have recommended and then make our adjustments after we've kind of collected some more data to really know if our taste buds like it or not.
I think there's some keywords here. If you're assigning them yourself, there may be some, like the unstable position. What that means is you can't set up or end a move on top of this terrain feature. So in the example of the ruined wall, you couldn't put your model up there, a wobbly model or whatever, and do that. And that's an intentional design feature, to your point.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you know, forgive my long-winded metaphor there, but
I'm hungry now.
I felt like there was some application to that, so.
That is how I judge people, by the way, also.
Oh, no. What have I done? No. So I agree. I think the terrain features really allow, or the terrain traits, sorry, really allow for you as a player to bring your like table to life. And I love it because I have like a lot of different terrain styles and sets and companies that make stuff. And it's really cool to be able to say, look, functionally, this is how this works on this table because of this and this and this. But it looks really cool. And that's why we're going to be playing in the middle of this barren wasteland or industrial sector or whatever. But I know I'm going to have some line of sight blockers because of this. And we're going to have some like crater style terrain because of that.
And if you're tired of your friend's repulsor going on top of the building, you can be like, you know what? That building is unstable terrain.
And I don't necessarily want to suggest this, but I think you have to avoid gotcha moments, is write it down. I mean, even if it's just on disposable note cards, that could be, you know, note cards of the moment or whatever, but write the keywords you assign the table, the terrain down, and put it right on the terrain feature, you know, or next to it or something, so you don't get hit with a gotcha moment. Like if you say something is not scalable or whatever, and somebody tries to scale it, you don't want to be having that discussion in turn three.
So I don't know about tournaments over. Well, I do know a little bit of tournaments over there, and I know I attended the LVO and things of that ilk. A lot of the terrains are very uniform. Like you'll get a ruin, an L shaped ruin, and there's like two on each table. And then if you've got 30 tables of terrain, 20 tables will have one of those ruins on it or two. It'd be very easy for TOs who have very standardized terrain that was for the last edition to simply just make a simple document saying, here's all the terrain types we have at our thing, and these are the ones that go with them. Here's the document in the players pack, and now you have a reason to read the players pack.
I agree 100%. But even in your home game, even in the test games or whatever, like, I think, right, because when you're, and I'm going to Ruined Walls as the example, I just read out what is essentially six different rules that you are supposed to remember in addition to your unit stats, your AP, your strength, all this stuff, your movement. You know, these are things, your stratagems you're thinking about. You know, I think it's really going to be somewhat easy to lose track of this. Now, look, this is the level of complexity that I really appreciate. This is not a fault in the design. I actually like this, that for every reason that we've given it so far. But it is something that I think you can lose sight of, even if it's a tense game. You have a very challenging turn one and two. You might forget that the armored containers are light cover or an exposed position or something. And that might cause a negative experience for you. I think you're better off if you just write it down.
Yes, definitely.
Agreed. Yeah, yeah. No.
I floated off on an island.
No. So I think to that point, and for event organizers, it might be a little resource intensive, but even having, you know, I saw some TOs that were looking at creating like cards or markers or tokens or something that actually have the keywords associated, and you can leave. There's probably better ways to go about how exactly you execute this to certain extents, and whether it's like a packet or something, but something that's visibly there and set that anybody can, whether you're referencing, like, you know, you mentioned at LVO, you could reference the packets that how the terrain was supposed to be set up and what the terrain was specifically, or if you have these tokens or cards or whatnot. I do think that's a huge player aid.
Yeah, and if you're having this discussion in a pickup game or in casual games or whatever, like, you know, use the rule of cool. If it looks like it should be exposed positions, then cool, but don't. I mean, I wouldn't. I think you need to be more sparing with some of these rules, like difficult ground. I think difficult ground is something this is going to come out weird, but let's just say we're playing one of those aforementioned orc armies, and I'm playing a filthy Xenos Tau army. I might suggest that, you know, that some of these things are difficult ground because it reduces your movement. And I think that's where the discussion, where both people should have to agree on it. But I wouldn't claim every hill is difficult ground, even when you are playing in the abstraction.
It's not the hill you want to die on.
Yes, oh, man. The unscripted folks.
With the references there. Another thing that's important to note is whether you're playing narrative games or you're playing match play, right? The way that terrain works is different. So in a match play game, you put objectives down first, and then you're supposed to set terrain and then adjust terrain with your opponent. Like, of course, tournaments are going to have the terrain set more than likely. But if you're playing like a tournament mission, you can't put any terrain on the objectives, et cetera, et cetera. You put terrain down before you even know what the deployment styles are or whatever, or who has what deployment zone. So you can kind of make sure it's even. Right. When it comes to a narrative play game, they encourage you to make the terrain and make it all narrative looking first, and then put objectives down to sort of like suit the terrain you put down. So I think that that's also important to note is you have like agency when it comes to the style of game you want to play, even with the terrain aspect.
Nice. Let me pause this riveting discussion on buildings and architecture in the 41st millennium.
And meals. Salty, salty, well-seasoned meals.
Yeah, and jump to... I have a group on Facebook that I manage called the Kitbash Crew, because I'm not a good converter. I'm not. I like green stuffing. I'm not doing. But kitbashing, I really enjoy it. It's attainable. It's a way to make models look different, you know, a little bit more unique, more personalized, or whatever. And you get that opportunity in the Indominus box set. Just a quick thing on painting. You were talking about the Royal Warden earlier. Mm-hmm. Painting that up for a buddy, and you know, I really like the way he looked, but the way I didn't do any embellishment to his head. I painted it the metallic color, highlighted it, and then gave him just a couple of little dots for yellow beady eyes. Man, he looked like a maniac. He looked positively unhinged. It's almost in a way that, like, I was disturbed. So I put a white stripe going down the middle of his head, like some folks have been doing. It's Mifri Dynasty or whatever, and it made him look a little less maniacal. And so if anyone else is having that problem out there, go with a stripe. A non-metallic stripe to maybe make your royal warden not look like he is an axe murderer. Unless that's what you want.
I was going to say, I think they did a fantastic job with the Necron aesthetic and really taking him to this next level of menacing. We're getting back to our Nightmare Terminator roots.
Yeah, no, for real. And looking at it,
they look good.
This is creepy. I need to do something here to make it look more like a, you know, space robot. I don't know, whatever. But with these Indominus kits, they're push fits, so you don't really need any glue to put them together. Like, it's kind of weird. It's like you need glue and you need clippers. I'm sorry, you need clippers, at least. You need tools. So why not throw some glue in there? I don't know. Maybe it's to get people on the table quicker, which is awesome. But what I've discovered, and this is after watching some tutorials and other people build this kind of stuff, is that when you're doing these push fits with the exact fitting, the exact tolerance, you know, big long poles that you slide things together with, that all like kind of pressure fits everything together. They're designed some way that if you're heavy handed with your glue, there's not a lot of space in there for the glue. And so you run the risk of things separating a little bit more than maybe they would if you were building them in a non-press fit situation. And so what I've done to help compensate for this, and I think this helps, is for those things with the long poles and stuff, I've actually trimmed off a little bit of the pole before sliding it into its housing with the glue. And I've found that gives me, I mean, at least in my experience, a better fit. So I have less gaps in between things that shouldn't have gaps. You see this a lot with a lot of people's outriders, is that, look, and if you're building your outrider and you that gap that's on the top of the two bits, the bike housing that fit together, you can diminish that with this tip. And if you use the decals out of the box, it actually helps shroud all that too. So there's a lot of steps along the way that you can shroud that. But for all these miniatures with the longer, like inch, quarter inch, three quarter inch poles that hold them all together, if you trim a little bit of that off, I think you find a little bit more space in there for the glue, which gives you a tighter seams, fits. You don't have those, you know, big glaring gaps on your models that look very beautiful. I mean, not the gaps, but the models themselves. These are really imposing, cool looking models, and you don't want those things. So this might help.
But don't be afraid to like modify them either. Like, you know, I found that with the chainsword intercessors, I was able to sort of, I have all 10 of them being completely different. Like, not completely different, but they're not the same pose. Even though it's supposed to be two units of five, I've been able to make them 10 individuals by, you know, being creative with some of the like arms and especially the arms and the heads to make them look unique.
That's cool, man. And so the heads, speaking of, you know, going back to the kitbash thing, I built a Marnius Calgar recently and he comes with two heads. I'm going to put Marnius's head like on an Eradicator or, I don't know, an Outrider, the helmetless one. So I don't know. It could be Alfarious. Marn Farius, he's everywhere. You know, I play Blood Angels, and I'm not using this as an excuse to talk about Blood Angels again.
It only took an hour. Yeah, there you go.
But the individual chapters, you know, they all have the cool head bits and stuff, even if it's in the upgrade sprue and stuff. So these models that already come with cool heads, if you do head swaps to them, you get to use their cool heads on different models like your intercessors or your sergeants or whatever. And so you get to spread all those around and get that kind of unique feel to your models. There's one blade guard that the head comes with a piece of the neck attached, like the piece of the gorget or gorget. I don't look. Internet, go for it. I don't know where you are with that word.
Gorget.
Yeah.
The French.
So whatever that piece is, it's attached to the head. And so I didn't feel comfortable clipping the head off because I felt like I'd never get that piece right where it needed to go in the neck. But that guy's got his power sword positioned in a way that's really easy to clip off. And I was able to put a Blood Angel, the cool Blood Angel wing with the power sword on that hand. And it worked out to where the wing, the cross guard bit of the wing, sits exactly on the guy's wrist guard where that piece of the other sword attached. And I was able to remove the sword in a way cleanly enough to where I could actually use that sword somewhere else. So again, you know, spread the bits love around and get some uniqueness in the model. So where he has the standard stock head, the other two, I was able to use some Death Company heads on them, which then frees up those like knightly crusader heads to be able to be used on other things. And anyway, I feel like I feel like I've cracked the code. I feel like get some, because I like those little touch. Like, you know, when I'm building my models, I do really try to imagine what their, you know, the personalities of whatever it is the figures are, what they're going to be doing on the table, how many, you know, of the whatever the foul enemy of whatever their creed is they're going to crush under their boots. And I don't know, the heads and the stuff, it's all part and parcel to that.
It's not our heads.
But this is all stuff like get your kit, and while you're building them together or putting them together, you probably have these parts laying around that you didn't use, and it's just kind of an excuse to look at them again and get some variance into your stuff. Because look, I mean, I don't know how many thousands of people crack this box open, and you know, you can get a little bit of variance on your stuff. Because I mean, like, I know personally, I'm going to field at least two units of Outriders, and I want them to look a little bit different. I know that people are going to be, I'm on the fence about the effectiveness of the Blade Guard. I don't know that I want to play with them I know I want to play with them. I don't know if they're going to make their way into a list, but I do know that when I field them, I don't want them to necessarily look the exact same as the guy next to them.
That's a real thing, right? Just like you said, Paul, adding that personality to it. And you know, for some of you that might be just getting into it, or if you're coming back to it, or even, you know, you've been playing. So like I've been playing the Crusade stuff personally with a buddy of mine who's just starting into it with his Black Templar. And he's really kind of like the same vein that you're doing with the Indomitus kit, really taken to it with, you know, some of the Sword Brethren bits, and really done an awesome job of stepping it up in regards of giving the Black Templar Indominus models he's got a real character of their own, which is exactly what you're saying. And I think that's crucial. I think that's a big deal in regards of your army and kind of the ownership that you take with it in regards to the hobby. I think it's a big deal.
Heck yeah. Well, thanks for joining us on this talk. I know but we will dive deeper into Xenos, but I know that we had several very heavy Imperium shows and wanted to spread it around and get a little, it basically just gets the list flow going for what might make it on the tabletop for folks, because it influences hobby decisions.
It does.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 100%.
Yeah. Well, thank y'all for joining me. Next week, remember to check your feeds. Show's coming. I'm going to put out shows every week. Thanks a lot for like, share, subscribing, leaving a comment. We got a great community on the YouTube page and on Twitter and Instagram and stuff. It's really cool to see everybody's hobby progress with the excitement of this brand new edition.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here, man.
We'll see y'all next week.
Make my day.